This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And hi, everyone. This is Kathleen Harris. This week, coming up later on the program, we're going to be talking with Cindy Hansel, the president of WISER, the Women's Institute for a Secure Retirement, about issues that relate to becoming suddenly single. What happens if all of a sudden you find yourself the sole person responsible for your finances, and maybe you're not prepared to do that? What are some of the things you need to be aware of in case a divorce, or maybe you get widowed, maybe those things happen to you and you have to sort of walk your way through a lot of things you're not particularly comfortable with? What should you do? Coming up on the second half of our program.
Today we're going to talk about estate planning and retirement planning. We're going to try to weave the two together because they both work in sync. And some of the issues we're going to be talking about is how to protect, for example, a widowed spouse. We're also going to be talking about protecting your lifestyle, and more importantly, in the very end, how to protect children, especially if there's a significant inheritance. Now, you've worked your entire lifetime to accumulate this wealth. You reach retirement. Well, once you get there, you want to protect that lifestyle and make sure you don't have to go back to work, or even worse, downsize because of either bad investments or things have not turned out the way you thought they would be. And remember, the one enemy of all retirees is inflation, because over time, even a 3 or 4% inflation rate can make a significant difference on your retirement lifestyle if you haven't planned for it. So we're not just talking about retirement, we're talking about seeing you through retirement, and then eventually passing the assets you've worked for onto your children and heirs.
Jim, it sounds almost like a preposition activity. To retirement, through retirement, beyond retirement. But I guess since you spend, you know, roughly a quarter to maybe even as long as a third, depending on when you retire and how long you live, quarter to a third of your lifetime in retirement, you know, you really want to make sure that you're protecting your lifestyle once you're there, because you're going to be in that phase of life for quite some time. So we've talked a lot about, you know, planning up to the point of retirement, planning to the point beyond retirement. But also, Jim, talking about things like protecting your spouse. Once the first spouse passes on, are your assets set up in a way that the assets left for your spouse are going to be sufficient to provide for him or her without you around and without your sources of income around? What about protecting your kids' inheritance, making sure your estate plan is set up in such a way that the assets that are left after the final spouse passes away go to the people that you had in mind? So let's start off, Jim, by talking about issues about protecting your lifestyle through those 20 or 30 years you might spend in retirement. So, you know, once a couple retires, your first several years, you know, we see a lot of people do a lot of traveling during this time, lots of time spent with family, time spent on hobbies. But the reality is that a lot of times medical expenses start to kick in and start to become a little bit more expensive. The beauty of all this is, Jim, though, is that we've had such huge advances in medicine that lifespans are getting longer and longer and longer. That's the pro side. The flip side of that is you have to make sure that those monies you've set aside plan for a longer lifespan than anyone in the history of the world has seen so far. So really just making sure that those funds stretch as long as they need to throughout the entirety of your retirement.
Now, as we go forward, I'm going to make some assumptions here. I assume that you either have the assets or you have either pension income to retire. The key is having increasing revenue. You have to have something that's going to keep pace with inflation. Maybe you're fortunate. Maybe you work for the government. You have some kind of COLA that is added to your pension, much in the same way that Social Security does. Of course, we all know that the COLAs that they use aren't the same COLAs that affect your lifestyle, but nonetheless, you have a source of increasing revenue. Because one thing I can tell you, expenses are going to go up each year for food, utilities, medical, whatever it is. I just got informed last night, my wife told me, that our utilities here in Southern California, as we close down a nuclear power plant, are going to go up 8% in September. And these are the kind of things that you will face over time. Your food bills will go up, medications go up, insurance premiums, gas at the pump, food, utilities, you name it, your lifestyle, the way you start out the day you retire, those expenses are going to change and go up over a period of time.
And Jim, you were talking briefly about some of the expenses that go up, utilities and food. You know, medical expenses are a huge part of that. We've been quoting a study by Fidelity. They do it about once a year. They figure out roughly how much your average couple retiring at age 65, living an average lifespan, will spend on medical care in retirement. And the average is roughly $230,000.
Wow, a lot of money.
So you divide that over 20 years, that's roughly $10,000 a year you need to have set aside for your healthcare expenses in retirement. So may not be something that you think about in your early retirement years, but those costs will definitely be increasing over time, along with everything else. You know, your living costs are going to increase too. So one of the things about retirement, Jim, is in the first maybe 3 or 5 years, you're not really noticing inflation so much. It's kind of a creep, one of those things that sort of creeps up on you. But after maybe 10 years, 15 years, you really start to feel the impact of that compounding inflation on your cost of living. So why don't we talk a little bit about that, about how that inflation creep can sort of really impact your total cost of living?
Well, if you take a look at various inflation rates, and some people use, you can use the government figure, which is roughly about 2%, and that takes into consideration all kinds of items that are figured in there. And of course, we know that they use sort of some statistical techniques to massage those numbers. For example, if the cost of beef goes up, it assumes that you stop eating beef and you start eating chicken. If chicken goes up, you go to fish. I don't know, if all three go up, maybe you go to Alpo. I don't know. But anyway, here's some facts that you need to think about. At a 3% inflation rate, your cost of living will double in 24 years. So if you start out in retirement and where you're going to spend 20 to 25 years between both of you in retirement, at a 3% inflation rate, at the end of your retirement years, your cost of living is going to double. At a 4% inflation rate, your cost of living will double in 18 years. A 5% inflation rate, it'll double in 14 years. And at a 6% inflation rate, 12 years. And the reason I use some of these higher numbers is a lot of times the things that really affect you, cost of prescriptions, utilities, cost of food, gas, a lot of the things that are basic cost of living are going up at a much faster rate than this overall 2% that we see in CPI. As I just mentioned, my wife told us, and come September, our utility bill is going up 8%. That's just for utilities. And we've seen other things go up at a much higher rate. The point of this discussion is your cost of living is going to be going up each year. And you need to have a plan to provide something that is going to increase over those years so you can maintain the lifestyle that you have the day you started retirement. You want to maintain that lifestyle till you're passing so that you never have to downsize, cut expenses, sell your home, get a reverse mortgage, do whatever it is. When you find yourself in a desperate strait, you don't want to do that. And all of this could be avoided if you do some proper planning up front.
And Jim, I think the important point here is that, you know, hopefully you have multiple sources of income in retirement. You've got Social Security, which does increase somewhat for inflation. You know, pension income, maybe you have some interest income coming in. I think the problem, Jim, is that for a lot of people, their primary sources of income in retirement probably aren't adjusted for inflation every year and probably don't increase every year. And that's kind of a problem when you see inflation rates going up 2, 3, 4%, but your income isn't changing. You can start to feel the pinch of that pretty quickly. And I think the other challenge, Jim, is that, as we've talked about many times, since 2008, people have been scared of certain types of assets, mostly stocks. And so since 2008, we've seen a lot of people move their portfolios, which is the portion of your income that you have a little bit more control over, have been moving those into cash and bonds, which, as we all know, have not been paying hardly anything. And so a lot of people have been dipping into principal for that reason. And even bond mutual funds, you've seen the dividend payouts on those bond mutual funds go down fairly significantly since 2008. So people that have been making those types of choices have seen their income level drop dramatically since 2008, just because of the realities of interest rates. So over time, their income stream's been going down. At the same time, their cost of living have been going up. And this trend of low interest rates is probably going to continue for some time in the future, but their inflation's not going to stop anytime soon. So one of the things you have to think about with your investment portfolio in particular is there a way that you can make your income stream increase to sort of match or keep up with the inflation that's happening at the same time? And there are ways to structure your portfolio to make that happen.
Yeah, there's a couple options that you have, so don't lose heart. One is you simply work longer. And the longer that you work, that means you're accumulating assets over a longer period of time, number one. And number two, you're going to have less years in which you're going to have to draw down on those assets. Another option that we're seeing become very popular today is individuals work part-time to supplement their income. I've had doctors that have continued to work beyond age 65 to bring in extra income, allowing their assets to accumulate, for example, pension assets rolled over into an IRA, or supplement their lifestyle. Maybe it's the extra part-time work that pays for the trips to Europe or other hobbies and things that they get involved with. And the third option is to have some investments that increase over time. And sometimes it may be a combination. You may work part-time. You may add some investments to your portfolio, like, let's say, dividend-paying stocks. Blue chip stocks, by the way, is what you should be using in retirement. And here's an interesting fact. You've heard it all the time on the financial news. You hear about corporate buybacks, dividend increases. The S&P 500 companies over the last 3 years have been returning more of their profits, which are at record levels, to shareholders in the form of what we call shareholder equity. They're buying back their stock, which makes your shares worth more because they're adding buying pressure to the stock, and at the same time, they're returning some of that cash and profits to you, the shareholder, in the form of dividends. This year alone, it's anticipated that dividend payouts will be another record year where S&P 500 companies will be increasing dividends by almost 12%. How many of you would like to get an 8 to 10% pay increase each year? This is the kind of thing that you're going to need throughout your retirement years, an increasing source of income.
Right. And again, Jim, the reason you need this increasing source of income is because you have an increasing spend rate because of inflation. And Jim, I think this whole issue about protecting your income using dividend paying stocks can seem problematic for a lot of people just because, you know, we've been through two back-to-back huge bear markets in the stock market. Again, the tech crash of 08, the tech crisis of 2000, and then the mortgage crisis of 08. You know, so people saw their assets in the stock market really crumble, and not to mention one of their primary sources of wealth, their home, was also decimated in value. So you can see why this whole issue of nervousness about the market and just fear about protecting the wealth you already have accumulated and not seeing that degrade anymore is a huge issue for people. So why don't we talk about this whole issue of the fear of losing the wealth that you've already accumulated?
Well, when you talk about your portfolio, that portfolio should be driven by your budget. And we've talked about this numerous times on the program, but you really need to find out, when it comes to your budget, what are your fixed living expenses? Because that should determine your sources of predictable income. And that is what is going to support your lifestyle. Now, outside of pension, outside of Social Security, what do you have coming in that is predictable, that you can count on? It's not going to change if the market fluctuates or the headline news changes. And I like annuities and laddered individual bonds because they're predictable. If you have an annuity payment, it's guaranteed by the insurance company. It doesn't change. It's like your pension. If you have a laddered bond portfolio and you lock in an interest rate of 4% on a bond, you're going to get 4% on that bond. If it has a 10-year maturity, every single year you'll get that 4%. At the end of 10 years, you get your money back when the bond matures. So the numbers in the income doesn't change. That's the most important thing that you need to do to protect your lifestyle. You don't want to start out in retirement with unpredictable income, income that could change at any moment. So what you want and what you're looking for, a key word, predictability. And you get that with laddered bonds. You do not get that with a bond fund, because bond fund dividends can change as redemptions happen. Last year, bonds were down 13%. Even though interest rates were going up, the income from a lot of these bond funds went down, because as people pulled money out of the bond fund, the manager was forced to sell those bonds at a loss. And then, of course, that loss is reflected to you, the shareholder, if you remain in the bond fund. Individual bonds that are laddered, they are guaranteed as long as the strength of the company that you invest in, either corporate or a sovereign, like, for example, a U.S. Treasury. And also an annuity is guaranteed as well. You have a contract with an insurance company. They guarantee to pay you X amount of dollars. It's kind of like the bank. It's based on assets they hold, whether they have a bond portfolio to match the income that you're going to need. But once again, what you're looking for to maintain that lifestyle is predictability.
And Jim, I want to circle back to what you just started this last comment with, which is that your portfolio in retirement should be driven by your budget. And so what you've just covered, Jim, are sources of fixed income. So dependable, solid income sources, which cover the basics or necessities in your budget. What about handling inflation and sort of the more non-essentials in your budget? What about providing for those over time?
There's a number of things that you can do that are going to provide, let's say, increasing income. Obviously, if you have a pension, I know a lot of teachers have a small increase each year. I think it's up to 2 to 3%. Some of the government pensions have COLAs. We know Social Security has a COLA increase. But the only other source that you have for increasing income outside of work are going to be things like stocks or rental real estate. And you need something in your investment portfolio that goes up each year. In the three sources we have talked about to increase your income over your retirement years are working, you could work part-time or work for an extended period of time, stocks, and especially blue chip stocks are the kind of stocks you want to own when you're retired, because you're looking more for safety. You don't want to worry about some hot flying stock that is the current fad. And rental real estate, because we know that rents are very, very tight. It's one of the things that's causing the CPI to go up right now is owner's equivalent rent. So when it comes to stocks, you want things that are basic, blue chip stocks, things that you find in the Dow Industrials. They're blue chip for a reason. They've been around for a long time. They have a franchise. They dominate their investment field. But I like, for stability, things like consumer staples. You know, are you going to stop buying shampoo, deodorant, toothpaste, food? We all have to eat. Utilities. You got to turn on the lights and bake in the oven. And energy, you're going to put gas in your car. Take a look at Warren Buffett's portfolio. Coca-Cola, consumer products company, Procter & Gamble. Recently, he just bought 40 million shares of Exxon. What are some of the characteristics of Warren Buffett's portfolio? Dominant blue chip companies have a franchise, they dominate the field that they're in, predictable cash flows, and provide basic necessities that people need to have. And this is the thing, with dividends, and especially with a lot of blue chip stocks, they're blue chip for a reason. They're mature companies, and they return money to shareholders in the form of dividends, and more importantly, those dividends go up each year. This year, as I mentioned earlier, it's estimated that the S&P will increase the dividends on top of last year's record, almost over 10% increase in dividends. This year, the S&P is expected to increase those dividends by 12%. How many of you would like to get a 12% pension or pay increase each year? Well, you can do that with blue chip stocks.
I can see all of our listeners raising their hands going, me. I want a 12% pay increase every year. Give me that. So, Jim, we've talked about two issues related to retirement and preserving wealth. We've talked about making sure that you can not only maintain your current lifestyle, but also protect your current level of wealth. Let's talk about what happens after. Let's talk about protecting the surviving spouse and protecting his or her wealth, talking about also passing wealth on to the kids. I'm just thinking of several situations we've become aware of here, Jim, of elder abuse, particularly with the surviving spouse, which is usually the wife or the mom of the family. And unfortunately, what tends to happen in some families is that there's usually one child, although sometimes more, usually one child who is using that surviving parent's wealth as their primary source of income. I guess what you would call a leech on their surviving spouse. Again, usually the mom constantly looking for handouts, maybe even moving in with the surviving parent and putting nothing toward the expenses of the household. So this is situations that are fairly common, actually, is for the surviving spouse. So what do you do if you have someone in the family who's unscrupulous in taking care of that surviving spouse? Or maybe there's a situation where the surviving spouse gets remarried again and the new spouse is not great with money or is going through all the saved wealth at a rapid speed, or maybe they get a divorce and that wealth gets given to the new spouse and it gets taken out of the hands of the family. And so these are all things that we've seen happen. Also, we've seen things happen where the surviving spouse maybe isn't all that knowledgeable about finances or money and tends to lean on a family friend or maybe one of their children that they perceive to be financially savvy. And oftentimes that advisor or that child will encourage the parent to make investment decisions that are not appropriate for their age and their situation, whether it's putting them into really high-risk investments or it's pushing all their funds into an annuity. We've seen a lot of situations where one of the family members has sort of stepped in as a financial advisor, and sometimes the advice really hasn't been so great. And again, the whole situation about the remarriage, you know, what happens if all the assets get commingled and then there's a divorce or the new spouse is just spending money like crazy? These are all things that you'll want to think about, you know, not only about you and what happens during your lifetime, but making sure that your spouse or your partner is covered and cared for after you're gone. So why don't we talk a little bit about ways to take care of your loved one after you pass?
You know, the best way to do that, Kathleen, is a successor trustee, somebody outside family and friends. And so many times we see some of the big mistakes that cause some of the issues you just talked about. Elder abuse, unscrupulous advisors, commingling assets, maybe in a second marriage, can be prevented when you have a successor trustee, somebody that's a professional, impartial, very knowledgeable about estate tax laws, income tax laws, things from IRA rollovers, but also, more importantly, is impartial. Because what you really want to do is you want to protect the surviving spouse. You don't want family and friends, which can get involved emotionally. How many of you have a son-in-law or daughter-in-law you're not particularly fond of? And you may be in a situation where the spouse is not savvy financially. And this becomes even a bigger issue when you have larger estates. The kids can put their needs ahead of a survivor. I was talking with a trustee yesterday, went out to lunch, and we're discussing a case where the surviving parent, in this case, the wife, needs to go into a long-term retirement care facility. The house was sold, and on top of that, there's a rental property that they would like to sell that the kids were using for a vacation. Well, we need the extra income. We need that because a long-term care facility is going to cost this one, because it's a nice facility, is going to cost over $5,000 a month. So when you think about $5,000 a month, there's $60,000. The kids didn't want the vacation home sold because they used it all the time. Unfortunately, it was needed to provide the extra income to take care of a long-term care living expense. And because interest rates are so low today, as you all are aware of, money doesn't buy what it used to. Interest rates aren't where they were. 5 years ago, I could have got 5% on a 2-year treasury note. Today, I'm lucky to get over 0.25%. So the trustee who was named in the estate plan came in and basically told the kids, I'm sorry, but your mom is our number one responsibility, and they're going to sell that vacation home. So this is why you want an impartial, sort of neutral person like a trustee that can come in to protect the surviving spouse and also avoid those conflicts with a son-in-law or daughter-in-law. And we had a situation where we'll discuss when we get to the case study today, where we had a large estate. There were one child from a previous marriage, the husband's daughter, and then there were three daughters of the wife from a previous marriage. The one daughter of the husband was a spendthrift. And as we get into the case with the three daughters, we'll tell you about how there was a test given by the mom to see how well they handled money, because it was a substantial estate, and they didn't handle it very well, which is why we have a successor trustee that's going to come in, and the assets will not go to the children. They'll get the income during their lifetime, but the principal eventually will go to the grandchildren.
And Jim, I think what you're bringing up too here is you're also talking about, you know, trust structures and legal structures that will help protect assets as well. AB trusts, charitable remainder trusts, these are all things you can talk about with your attorney. And Jim, I think this brings up the last issue about protecting your assets. So we've talked about protecting them during your lifetime, protecting your surviving spouse. What about protecting assets for your survivor and for your heirs? So the next generation, what happens if your kids really aren't equipped to handle large sums of money? Maybe they're not experienced with investing, or maybe they aren't really great with money in general. You know, again, this brings up the issue with commingling assets after a divorce. So let's say that you do leave your child a large sum of money at your passing, but it's not protected in any way. So your child goes through a divorce with their spouse, and once again, you find your hard-earned money, instead of being used to protect or help your child, is now being used for their ex-spouse. So again, there are ways to protect your heirs, again, from these same situations happening. So Jim, why don't we talk about some of those?
One of the most important things, and especially when it comes to a large estate, is first of all, discussing it with the parents. They know the family dynamics. If open, well, then you can develop a plan that takes into consideration not only a plan for the parents, but also a plan for the kids. So the kids are going to have a financial plan, especially if they're going to come into a large inheritance, because they need to learn or develop skills to deal with this kind of wealth. So the children, in addition to the parents, will have their own financial plan. And that really takes some openness and something that the parents feel very comfortable with, that their kids can handle the additional wealth that they're going to inherit. They're responsible, because in many cases, it could be life-changing. All of a sudden, you know, mom and dad were very successful. They have a large estate. And all of a sudden, when they pass on, the kids could be inheriting millions of dollars, which can completely change their lifestyle. So over the years, one of the things that we have done to protect children from all of the very same things that a surviving spouse is subject to is generation skipping trusts, where we can have income go to the children, but the principal remains intact. I mean, if you think about some of these large families that you've seen over the years, the Kennedys, the Rockefellers, how did they amass such a fortune and still remain as wealthy as they are today with all the estate tax rates? Remember, at one time, the exemption for assets was only $175,000 prior to Ronald Reagan. There were estate taxes on the death of the first spouse, and the tax rates were as high as 70%. Now, today, we're fortunate. You can pass on $5.3 million with no estate taxes. With the living trust, husband and wife can pass $10.6 million, and the tax rates are only 45%. But how do you amass a legacy? Think about that. Over decades, not just your children, but your children's children. And you can do that with some legacy planning. But you have to have a plan to implement it. It takes foresight. And there's nothing worse than to build an estate and see it dissipated with either the surviving spouse because taken advantage of, or with children who become spendthrifts. The wealth needs to be nurtured just like it does during your retirement years. It's a very delicate subject, and not all parents are ready to talk about it, and they may be in a situation where it just doesn't work with the children. But it needs to be discussed between parents and children, husband and wife, and you need to have a plan, because think what changes in their lifestyle. Think of the amount of money that you have right now. Ask yourself a question. If this large amount of money was passed on to my children, are they equipped financially to handle it, number one? And number two, are they responsible enough? Will they be prudent and take care of that principal and nurture it and build it? Or will they be spendthrifts? Those are big questions you have to ask.
So again, Jim, I think this is really important in terms of really doing some advanced planning. You know, if you're talking about maintaining your lifestyle through your retirement and protecting your wealth so you can pass it on and protect your surviving spouse and provide a legacy for your children, again, we're talking about multi-generational planning here, about not just looking at your lifespan and your spouse's lifespan, but your kids' lifespan and maybe even your grandkids' lifespan. So the planning is not just for your retirement, it's for retirement and beyond. Again, your surviving spouse, your kids, and your grandkids. I want to circle back to something you said earlier, Jim, about spendthrift children. Or, you know, what do you do if you know that some of your children maybe aren't so great with money? How do you handle that? We had a situation where we had a very, very large estate that we were working with, and the husband passed away and left a very sizable sum for the spouse. Some of the funds were locked up in charitable remainder trusts so that the principal couldn't be accessed. Some of the funds were locked up in marital trusts so the principal couldn't be accessed by the surviving spouse. But she also had a fair amount of money that was in her survivor's trust that she had access to that she could do whatever she wanted with during her lifetime. So she thought, you know what? I'm going to try this out with my kids. I'm going to see how they do with this sizable chunk of money. So she gave her three girls each $1 million and saw what they did with it. And within a year, every single one of those three children had made decisions with that money that mom was not happy with and she was not thrilled with. So what she's decided to do is put into place a successor trustee who's a professional who can make the right decisions for the children and make sure that those assets that are left behind don't get spent in a reckless fashion by the kids. So again, this is situations where you're doing some advanced planning to figure out what's the best way to pass this money on to my children. And if my children aren't responsible or able to do this asset management on their own and be smart with the money, maybe I appoint someone to be my successor trustee who is going to be good with money and who is going to be responsible with my wealth to make sure that it gets passed on in a way that I'm comfortable with.
You know, this was an interesting case because it started out with a retirement plan. And in this case, the husband had a company, and it was a very successful company, and he was taken out by a public company. It was a foreign company. We did the research on the ownership of that company, and then we structured the sale through a charitable trust so that stock was exchanged for stock, and there was no taxation of that event. And then the stock was transferred to a charitable trust, so not only did he get a significant tax deduction, which we used over a couple of years, and we were able to draw large amounts out of his IRA at that time and use some of these charitable deductions to offset it. But more importantly, we saved at that time a significant difference in terms of capital gains taxes, 20% on the federal side, and of course 9.3 on the state of California. So almost one-third would have went out the window in taxes. So instead of paying a third of it away in taxes, we almost saved a third in taxes over the years because we were able to use the charitable deduction. And we took a 6% distribution rate, meaning that each year the value of those assets, whatever that value is, the couple themselves would receive 6% income out of the charitable trust. It would be ordinary income. So we avoided the one-third shrinkage and actually saved taxes in the process. Now today, that estate is broken up into four trusts. We have the charitable trust, which came about from the sale of the company. And then we have three separate trusts. We have the wife's trust, the husband's trust, and a separate trust that was set up for the husband's daughter. And in this case, the wife gave part of the assets, sort of a testing period of $1 million to each one of the children, and that was not handled well, especially with the son-in-laws get involved, one which not particularly fond of. And so now the remaining assets upon her death, the charitable trust will get dispersed to their charities that they named at the time the trust was set up. And then the other trust will be held in trust for the children. It'll be kept as separate property if they get divorced or whatever the circumstances are. That principal will be held and be managed and protected for the surviving children. And this was a case where we will be doing generational planning and even focusing on the grandkids as we now have a financial plan for the kids. And the kids, well, let's put it this way. Three of the daughters got $1 million up front. So that changed their lifestyle with new homes, cars, and trips that they weren't able to afford or do had that gift not been given. But once again, instead of husbanding that money and making it grow, that was not what happened here. A lot of it was spent and dissipated. So you can see here was a case, tax planning was involved. We had dividend-paying stocks that increased over time. And you can see that kind of wealth takes a lot of planning, and not everybody is ready to handle that. A lot of children cannot handle the disbursement of $4 or $5 million. What would they do with that? So here's a good example, Kathleen, that over time, not only did the plan change, especially on the death of the husband, where there was sort of this period of time where money was dispersed and the surviving spouse got to see how those children handled it. And sometimes you need to do that because you really don't know. If they can't handle $1 million, how are they going to handle $5 million? And the decision was made early on by the husband, who saw that the children didn't have that capability, that the assets would be tied up for their benefit.
And Jim, I think all this really dovetails beautifully with our conversation coming up with Cindy Hounsell, the president of WISER, the Women's Institute for a Secure Retirement. You know, she and I talked about what happens when you are that surviving spouse. What do you do? What are the things that you need to think about? What are the considerations you need to have in mind? And so that's coming up, my conversation with Cindy Hounsell, right after this. Welcome to the second half of today's Lifetime Income program on Financial Sense News Hour. Now, we all know one thing is certain about life, and that is that nothing is certain in life. You know, sometimes events surprise us, whether it's something to do with our work or our families. It seems like, you know, we're not always in control of the things that happen to us. Today on this program, we'll be talking about suddenly single issues that people that find themselves in a situation where they're in a divorce or suddenly widowed need to keep in mind and think about in terms of their finances. So if you're someone who is a widow or has been going through a divorce, has a child going through a divorce, listen up, because we're going to have a conversation with Cindy Hounsell, president of WISER, the Women's Institute for a Secure Retirement, about some of the issues for folks who find themselves suddenly single. Cindy, I was sort of thinking about how there's some things you can do ahead of time to make that sort of separation shock a little bit less crazy when something like that happens, like a prenuptial agreement, or maybe being involved in financial affairs with your partner, maybe mentoring someone to help take over financial affairs, or setting up a fiduciary relationship. Can you think of some other things you can do ahead of time to make the transition a little bit less bumpy in terms of finances?
I'll probably just add more to what you were saying, but I think, you know, you sort of covered a good number of the issues, is that, you know, women have to not wait for events to take them over. They need to sort of take over their financial life as soon as they can, when they're working, when they're married, and sort of take steps at each of those stages and not think that there's time to be waiting to catch up. And I think in my experience, the worst thing that's happened to women is something happens, they have no preparation, they have no money in a divorce. What happens to a lot of women, because they make their children the priority, which, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're in a marriage, I think both people should be making the children a priority, right?
Well, that would be the ideal, yes. Regardless of whether that marriage succeeds or doesn't succeed, the children obviously come first.
Right. But what happens is, and it's not the fault of either party in some ways. It's often the advice of the divorce attorneys, because it's like to win, to get the best deal for your client. You know, they're always giving you suggestions about how to make the other party acquiesce. And so women often, you know, do the things that are not helpful to their future. You know, they'll keep the house, and that's not a good financial move. Often they've lived in the house for a long time, and by the time they're taking the house on so that their children won't have to change schools, the house needs a lot of repairs and things, and so they end up in a really tough financial position right after the divorce. So it's that type of thing. And not having enough money, if you have enough money that you can get your own attorney, but women don't take part in the finances of investment. They'll often take part in the paying of bills, but they won't look at the bigger picture of the family's finances. And so I think, you know, what happens is they get sort of behind from the beginning when there's a situation. And your spouse, who, you know, you love each other, you know, no matter what, can get in an accident and you find out that all these accounts and things you don't have access to. So you're in trouble because of that. And it sort of all goes back to, you know, if you're in a relationship with anyone, you need to be right up there, step by step, for every part of your financial life.
I was thinking too, Cindy, I think one of the things that a lot of our clients don't take into account is the way their assets are registered together and the type of marital property state they live in.
Right.
Whether the state does community property or tenants in common, or even acknowledges common law marriages, which I think is something a lot of people don't take into account when they're going through these agreements, is the common law marriage as well. Would you mind talking a little bit about things people should be aware of in terms of the way the state is viewing the type of marriage situation?
Well, I think, first of all, there aren't a lot of common law states anymore. I can't remember the number, but it's pretty low. And that, I think, is a bigger and bigger problem. It may become true for the millennials, but it's pretty much true for the baby boomers, where you have a lot of people who may have been married once and then they have a second relationship and they just decide, you know what, I'm not going to marry again. And then they end up doing all the same things, putting all their eggs in somebody's basket, and then there is no common law marriage recognized. I know two people going through this right now. Both of these women are really savvy and are kind of amazed to find themselves in these big fights in their early 50s when they never expected these relationships to go sour in any way and made no accommodation for any of their finances, you know, paying into a house that their name wasn't on, that type of thing.
Which I think is something else, you know, you'd mentioned earlier about titling. And one of the things is just to make sure that your name is on the titling of things.
Exactly. And that includes even your utilities. I know a number of women who have found out the hard way that, you know, you move into the house and maybe you have small children at the time and your spouse's name is on all the utilities. And so then after the divorce, and that's true even if you're widowed, your name has to go on. And so then there are all these other higher expectations and costs involved to do that.
And also hassle factor.
Yep.
I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about retirement benefits and sort of the special things to be aware of in terms of retirement benefits when you're going through a divorce.
Well, I mean, I think the first thing is finding out where all the accounts are. That's really important, because a lot of times people can have a number of different accounts. And I think one of the important things is, and I've only decided this myself, is, you know, we all talk about like how long you have to save your taxes, but you can save your W-2 forms forever. I know somebody who's just getting a pension that they told her she wasn't eligible for from 20 years ago, because she actually had her boxes of taxes. But, you know, you think how small that W-2 form is. Why are we not saving those forever? You know, because they check off the pension box, and that's what the company said to her. If you have a copy of your W-2 from, you know, 20 years ago, and the pension is checked off, you'll get the pension.
Wow.
I know. Isn't that amazing?
That's amazing.
Yes. So I think that's something we should all be doing. You know, you don't have to save the whole big, fat tax return, but you should be saving your W-2 forms.
Right, because it helps kind of know where the retirement money is. And that's kind of employer retirement money. Then you've got IRAs on the side.
Right.
I was also thinking, too, about knowing what pensions are coming due for the spouse. So money they don't have in hand right now, but pension money they're entitled to, maybe from prior work or from the military or from the government.
Right. And every state has different laws about this. It's state-based. So I think the important thing there is to... Also, on the tax returns, there are copies of all your IRA statements. There may not be copies of the military pension, because I think that's just a different category. But I think it is important to know where all of the different sources of retirement income are, and
right,
make sure that you have all of that in hand. And, you know, it's one of those things women should start doing every year, and even planning. You know, if you and your spouse are sort of at cross purposes of your investing, that doesn't help anything either, because you both have IRAs in different places that you never really talk about. You know, someday you actually may live together, you know, for the next 50 years, and you'll want a decent retirement. So it's the planning piece that people often don't do, especially, you know, in the first years of marriage.
Right. Well, I was thinking too, you know, maybe the pension income isn't coming in now, but it's income that they're entitled to in the future, which is information you would want to make sure is covered in the divorce decree.
Right. And as I said, you know, there are different rules for every state where, you know, you have like when the pension should be divided and, you know, which years should be counted. Obviously, the years that you were living together, you know, from the date of marriage up to the date of separation. And sometimes it's the date of divorce, you know, which is a longer period. And sometimes you can maneuver those things and get a better deal than what the state rule is, you know, depending on your spouse.
What about if your spouse was eligible for some form of disability benefit?
Well, that can sometimes change what you're eligible for. You know, sometimes you may be eligible for the pension and then the spouse becomes disabled pension, and certain places you're not eligible for that.
So that's something else to sort of do some forensic work on. I was also thinking about situations where maybe you are also taking care of some children or what have you, knowing what happens to your share of the pension if you were to predecease your spouse.
Right. And making sure that if you are counting on anybody else's pension, you need to know what the rules are and how much you will be eligible for. And usually, if it's a private pension, the law requires that if you give up that benefit, you have to sign a waiver and it has to be notarized. There's a whole process that you have to go through. So I think it's important to know that.
Do you think it's beneficial for most folks to go through and have some form of a pension actuary review all this retirement information as part of the legal process?
Yes. I mean, I think if you can afford to do that, which can be expensive, but I think it's important to know that before you ever go through. I mean, if there's a split in the marriage, we keep talking about the marriage is splitting up. And I think, you know, the actuaries can tell you what the value is, you know, what the value is over a lifetime. So it's certainly a big help in that division of assets.
Why don't we talk a little bit, too, about the quadro and what that is and things to keep in mind when you're dealing with a quadro?
Right. Well, one of the things that I try to really impress women with, and it scares a lot of women when they hear this, because a lot of times there are women that have been divorced a long time ago, and they may not have that document, and it's coming up closer to their ex-husband's retirement. So the way I usually describe the quadro, I'm saying it the way it looks or sounds. It really stands for the Qualified Domestic Relations Order, and it's just an easy way to refer to that as a quadro. And what it does is it's like the ticket to get you in the movie. Like you can go online, you can buy a ticket, but when you show up at the theater, if you don't have the ticket in hand, you're not seeing the movie, right? And what happens with the quadro is it's a pretty simple document, but it is signed by the court. And what it does is it goes to the retirement plan, and it allows the plan to see what is in your property agreement and what percentage you're getting of the pension, the name of the pension, the address of the pension, every piece of information that's necessary that goes on that document to get part of the pension. If you don't have that, even if you have a property agreement that says the pension will be divided, you will not get that pension.
Wow, so the quadro is really important.
Right, and it's important because you can go back to court, but if somebody passes away or dies, then there's no way to do that. So you're waiting for this pension to come, and while you're waiting, you don't have the correct document to get paid. You don't have the ticket. So if somebody dies, then it's over. There is no way to go back to court to get what you needed to do. And over the years, that's where there are a lot of glitches in people getting the divorce share of the pension.
So if there's pension money involved, IRA money involved, any kind of retirement money involved, to make sure that you have a quadro in hand as part of that divorce process.
Right. And it needs all the accounts, because sometimes people have two or three accounts. You know, their employer may have had one type of an account and then switched over the pension to a 401k or, you know, from a defined benefit plan, a traditional pension.
Switching gears a little bit to some other topics here, I was thinking about, why don't we talk a little bit about what happens to health benefits you might have been entitled to under your spouse's work health care plan?
I think usually what happens, and I'm not the big expert, you know, there's so many changes. Normally what would happen before the new health care law, they usually don't provide it for the ex-wife. What they do is they'll just make sure that there's money there to either pay for her benefits after her COBRA runs out. And so there are a lot of different issues now with COBRA, which is the extension. Usually you get 18 or 36 months after a divorce for the health care benefits.
So you're saying the COBRA basically would still be available for the former spouse on the primary wage earner's health care plan. The ex-spouse could actually take advantage of COBRA for the next 18 to however long that period of time is for health care coverage.
Right.
If they chose to go that route.
Right. And then a lot of times what also happens is if there's financial leeway in the relationship, you know, a lot of times the spouse will pay until the kids get out of high school, you know, if the wife is staying at home so that she'll have access to health care as well.
I'm thinking also of, that's assuming that you're not on Medicare or what have you, but speaking of other government benefits that are, might be related, I'm thinking about Social Security benefits. And if you have access to your spouse's earnings through your Social Security benefit after a divorce.
Well, I mean, the Social Security is separate. You need to be married for 10 years. That's the big issue. And if you don't have that 10 years and you have 9 years and 7 months, you don't qualify for anything. So it's really because there's no division. There's no earning, sharing, or division for Social Security. And a lot of the changes over the last few years have been that, you know, divorce lawyers will say, because we hear these same stories over and over again, people call us and tell us. So, you know, we know this isn't just happening once. They'll say, you know, the divorce lawyer says that they'll allow me, you know, to take my Social Security benefits, you know, my husband's spousal benefit, if I do the following. And there is no such deal maker, you know, available from the Social Security system. It's a federal system. If you've been married 10 years or longer, you're entitled to a spousal benefit, which is half of your ex's benefit. And in the future, if that person dies, you're also entitled to the full amount. As a divorced spouse, you're really considered the same as a married spouse as long as you have that 10 years.
So note to self, Social Security benefits are non-negotiable, so they shouldn't be part of the negotiation over assets and all the stuff that goes in part of the divorce agreement.
Right. I mean, the only time you need to negotiate is if you have 9 years and 11 months, you need to drag the divorce out for
another. Exactly. Just keep hanging on for a couple more months.
Exactly.
Right. Right. I was also thinking, you know, what about as you're crafting these agreements, you know, wondering about what effect, you know, remarriage would have on some of these benefits and some of these agreements?
For the Social Security, the remarriage means that it's gone. You now have the new spouse, unless the new spouse dies, and then you can get whichever benefit is larger from the old spouse or the new one. You know, the rules all change, and you still have dual eligibility if one of them dies, especially the one you've remarried. But the other things, the pension, all of that really has no effect. I mean, you've agreed you're going to get part of that benefit. Alimony has become a big issue, and I'm not sure if you're aware of that, but there have been some states that say that you can go back to court and you can reopen. A lot of the second wives are very unhappy that their spouses are paying these large alimony payments, and they may not even be large payments, you know, to someone they've been divorced for 20 years or so. So that's a whole new area. And I forget, there were 11 or 12 states the last time I looked, and I haven't heard differently or looked. But I know people being taken back to court, and especially in Florida, you know, you have women in their 80s who are now losing out on the alimony, and they may not have taken part of the pension because a lot of divorce lawyers would try to talk to you about, you know, the fact your husband will give you more if you give up the pension because then he can get a tax break from giving you alimony. So there were all these complicated reasons why people accepted alimony. You know, they may have even given up the house and taken the alimony. And now it's a whole new ballgame. So it means you always have to be on your toes and paying attention and trying to think of where will the money actually be in hand and, you know, how can I make sure that if I'm dividing up these things or considering, you know, and the pension is to be paid for life, that might be the better choice for me to take the pension.
More dependable, less negotiable.
Right.
So we've talked a lot about situations in which you're suddenly single due to divorce, but then there's also, of course, the other thing that tends to happen to a lot of people, particularly women, is to be suddenly single because your spouse passes away or your partner passes away. And some of the things to sort of be aware of when that happens.
Right. And I think, you know, that's similar where you need to have your name on everything. I mean, you know, it's obviously not the same situation, but, you know, it has a lot of the same problems, like knowing where everything is, having your name on everything, maybe having a plan beforehand for both of you. I mean, people can be in comas, people can be in car accidents. So, you know, the same type of thing will happen. But we did a widow's survey, which is on our website at wiserwomen.org, and we did it last fall, in the fall of 2013. And, you know, what we found is that there are just so many women, you know, depending on which question you ask, you know, a third who have like no idea really about the finances and just found themselves in a really bad situation at a horrible time in their lives. I mean, the last thing you want to be doing is scrounging around for paperwork, right, during a time when you're just devastated.
Right. Grieving is not a good time to start doing financial 101.
Right. So pushing, you know, and having that talk.
Having that uncomfortable discussion about what happens, and that would include, I think a lot of people, when you're sitting down and doing your retirement planning, something to think about is the survivor benefit on any pensions.
Right.
That could make a significant difference if something happens to the primary wage earner in terms of the surviving spouse's ability to make ends meet.
Right. And a lot of times people don't even choose a beneficiary. That's even a bigger problem. You know, they start at a job and they may never update because they just never get around to it. And, you know, the HR departments, a lot of times, you know, change over, benefits change over decades. And so you want to make sure that all your beneficiaries are current and to the people that, you know, you want to make sure are taken care of. And same thing with life insurance, you know, making sure that the wife is the beneficiary or, you know, the husband, whichever way that works.
I was thinking, too, I know that one of the things we encourage the widows that we work with to do shortly after their spouse passes away is to come in and meet with us so we can help them do a review of all the assets, all the income, and figure out where they're at now that their spouse is gone. Maybe they need a new financial plan or a new income plan. Now that the spouse is gone, maybe the pension income changes or what have you. And so maybe now it's time to recalibrate everything. And so you sort of restart the financial planning process with a clean slate in a way after the husband passes to create a new plan just for the widow who maybe doesn't always know where everything is. What's a good way to gather all the information too is to do that.
Right. And I think it's also helpful because a lot of times women in other surveys I've seen feel like they're not getting the help they want from the financial advisor. And so then they go looking elsewhere. So they really are looking for that type of assistance.
Right, which I think is a red flag for our industry to be aware of, is that if we don't provide this service, the client will find someone else who'll be a lot more willing to sit down and take the time. I've talked to a lot of women who are widowed fairly young who are really surprised to hear about the survivor benefit for Social Security. So why don't we talk about that for a few minutes?
One of the wonderful things, though, I will say, is that I think there's been a huge change over the years that the funeral directors often sign people up, and I've heard that story over and over again.
Do they really? That's fantastic.
It's wonderful, and I say this because I've heard that over and over again, and I've had in my own circle like a number of young women and, you know, the children of friends of mine who have had these horrible things happen, you know, two or three children and spouses, terrible illness, and in a very short time or an accident, something happening. And the minute they call me and they say, can you help, you know, the employee benefits, and then I say, well, the first thing is get the kids on Social Security, and they say, oh, no, that already happened when we went to see the funeral director. They had all the paperwork filled out.
Oh, that's great.
Which is just wonderful. And I think also Social Security has worked with that industry to try to help make that happen, and probably 9/11, you know, those big situations really pushed that forward. So that piece of it is sort of amazing to me, but it's happening.
So who exactly is eligible for a survivor benefit in Social Security?
Well, you know, the widow is eligible when she's taking care of children up to the age of 16, and the children are eligible up to the age of 18, and then the spouse is available again at age 60. Unless she's disabled, she's able to get her survivor benefit at age 50. And all of that is on the Social Security website. There's a special section for widows and widowers.
I was also really surprised to hear that if you are a parent whose child passes away and your child was providing a significant portion of your income for you, that you're also eligible for this benefit as well. So talk to your local friendly Social Security office.
And also go online, because the Social Security offices right at the moment have had a lot of cutbacks and there's a huge wait time at a lot of offices.
And socialsecurity.gov is frankly a fantastic resource. There's a lot of great stuff you can do on that website.
Right. And you can call actually and get answers to questions, or you can email, I think, on the site as well.
I think with the baby boomer population sort of coming through the retirement circles and all of the health issues that sort of start to come with that and financials come with that, hopefully the dialogue about some of these issues, the pre-planning issues about staying on top of finances in general and talking with your spouse and doing some estate planning will help prevent some of these things from being such a nasty shock.
Right.
But everyone's not built the same way. And for some people, it's just staying on top of the finances isn't going to be part of their approach to life.
Right. And, you know, every situation is different, where you have somebody in the couple and it may be the couple that becomes absent is the one who wants to take care of it. And a lot of times I hear from women that they're just happy when their spouse will take care of something. You know, they're running around doing the, you know, they're spending their lunch hour, you know, calling the dentist and doing all those things. And
right.
So, you know, if he'll just take care of some of that, that's more why they give it up. It's the timing issue.
Yeah.
It's not even so much that they're not interested. It's just that, you know, it's one more thing on the list.
Trying to make the time for it to happen. Always a challenge for everything, it seems like. Well, do you have anything else you want to share with our listeners as far as things they should be thinking about if they should become suddenly single as it relates to finances?
Well, the other thing I was thinking is just that, you know, for the group of women that are now part of the baby boomer, it's the largest group of never married women coming forward. So, you know, these are women that also need to really be paying attention to a lot of the things we're talking about, like disability insurance, all those things that if you're on your own, you may need. And also, even if you're young, you know, you want to have your end-of-life plan in place, or some kind of a plan, or someone who knows what your wishes are. And a lot of times that's something that younger women just ignore because they just don't pay attention to it.
Well, again, it's not one of those things that everyone likes to dwell on, but I always remind people that it's a huge gift to those you leave behind to leave things in good order and leave a plan for what you wanted to have happen. It's a huge gift and a blessing for people. Well, Cindy, as always, what a pleasure to have you on the program. Would you mind sharing with everyone where they can find out more information about Wiser?
Sure. We have a whole section on divorce and widowhood, and also a lot of information, just basic financial information for everyone. And this goes for men, too. We're not excluding the men. Most of the things I said are also just gender neutral. You know, it's just that often, you know, the women find themselves being the party in the relationship where they're not paying as much attention to it. But it's wiserwomen.org, and it's sectioned off in a way I think that's really easy to read about divorce and widowhood.
Fantastic. And don't you have a seminar that you do every fall? I'm wondering if you have one coming up this fall you might want to tell people about.
We've just done a whole series actually over the summer. We have a number of events that we have planned. So we have one planned in D.C. on September 30th, and that information will be up on our website, and one in Minneapolis in October.
Thanks again for all your information, Cindy. It was wonderful to talk to you again.
Same here. Thank you so much.
Again, this is Kathleen Harris for Financial Sense NewsHour's Lifetime Income segment. Really want to thank our guest, Cindy Hounsell from Wiser, the Women's Institute for Secure Retirement, for her tips on things to keep in mind if you find yourself in the situation where you are suddenly by yourself making all these big financial decisions. So for myself and Jim, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.